Well, hello everyone. I am Billy Tees, and I'm here today for HumorOutcast.com and Corner Office Books, HO Press, all of the fine folks there. When you do get a chance, check out HumorOutcast.com, the place to take a humor break. On the phone with me today, I have Daniela Gitlin. How are you doing, Daniela?
I'm good. And yourself?
I am doing good. Now, she is the author of the book, Practice, 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 This Psychiatrist's Life. And let me tell you a little bit about Daniela. Daniela is a rural psychiatrist in private practice with her husband, who is also a psychiatrist in upstate New York. She is an avid reader and quotes Frank Zappa. So many books, so little time. Interesting quote. Now, I'm not sure I have this word right. She is a fan of Areopagitians. How do you say that word, Daniela?
Areopagitians.
Okay, there you go. which are figures of speech in which the later part of the sentence is unexpected. For example, you might say, the last thing I want to do is hurt you, but it's still on my list. Or you might say, if I agreed with you, would both be wrong. So she enjoys the humor in those. Her book gives you a view of therapy sessions from her side of the couch, along with transcripts of what's going through her mind as she's working. And it's not what you think. Along with stories from her growing up and training years, the majority of the book spans 25 years of rural psychiatric practice. Written with candor and a light touch, these clinical and personal tales reveal a way of thinking that is essential for living actively, fully, and doing good work with a sense of wonder. Okay, interesting. I'm kind of drawn to this. You often get asked if you and your husband analyze each other.
Yes, that is a very classic question.
Yeah, and it's a cliche, and I won't go there, but I can't believe that during an argument, things don't come up. I'd like to be a little fly on the wall for that.
Well, you know, when we were first married and we were in training, we trained together. We went to medical school together and we trained together. And yes, during those early years of the marriage, I did a lot of that kind of analyzing what was motivating him.
I know this,
it's not a good thing to do. It's really not. I'm married 38 years now. And I would say about 25 years into the marriage, I realized that this was not a good thing, and I stopped.
Yeah. Well, it's a cliche, but I'll say it. I'm pretty sure that women in general do this, but anytime a guy acts in a way that they don't like, it's always because of your mother. This is because of your mother.
Well, there's some truth to that. Like all cliches, there's a kernel of truth.
Yeah, I do believe that. Now, you are in New York now, and I know this is a long story. You can give us the short version. Where are you from originally?
Well, my parents are European, and my father worked for the UN. So when I was a baby, they traveled quite a bit.
Okay.
And then my father got a job working for the UN, and he was he was stationed in Santiago, Chile. So I spent the first 5 years of my life basically in Chile,
sure,
where my brother and my sister were born. And then my parents got divorced there, and my mother remarried, and my stepfather was a professor at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. So I grew up, I actually went to school, elementary school and high school in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to New York City, and that's where I went to college. And it was then that I got my degree in English and fine art. And I decided after I had finished, it took me 6 years because I worked part-time all the way through my college years. I worked full-time all through my college years. I decided at that point that I couldn't support myself making art.
Right.
And I met my husband once I made the decision to go to medical school, and I was in I went back for my pre-medical coursework, and I met him at that time.
Okay.
And so, you know, we went to medical school in Tennessee, and then did our training in the Bronx at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And from there, we relocated upstate New York to where, you know, where we've been for the past 25 years.
Yeah.
So that's the long and short of it.
How did psychiatry enter in? Was this something that you were always interested in, or what gave you the push to go in that direction?
Well, I was very, I had a difficult childhood.
Okay.
And actually, I was a runaway. I ran away from home.
Really?
And I went to live, yes, and I lived with my father, and his wife for a year in New York. And my stepmother ultimately became a therapist, and they connected me to my first therapist, who was a psychiatrist. And I had one of those after, you know, struggling to be an artist. I'm an introverted person. It's very hard for me to sell myself.
Right.
And I'm easily squashed by criticism. And, you know, to be an artist, you have to be, a professional artist. You have to be hardy to criticism and really know your own mind. And I was young and unformed, but I was also very drawn to the whole thinking, the process, the thought process of therapy. Because as I was in therapy when I was young, and I have to say it saved my life. And I had this epiphany, you know, you have to read the book to get this story. I can't tell you all the, the details of these stories are in the book. But I've always been a person who people talk to. And I've always been a person that asks good questions. And I had an interaction with a friend of mine that proved very helpful to her. And many weeks later, as I was, you know, walking home from work and wondering what the heck I was going to do with myself, it came to me as one of those blinding aha moments that I should be a therapist. Mm-hmm. And I ran it by my psychiatrist therapist, and he was surprisingly supportive of the idea. Wow. I expected him to be, you know, neutral, but he was very supportive. And for reasons that you'll have to find out from reading the book, he persuaded me to go to medical school. And so that was how I went to medical school, which was completely out of my box, completely out of my box.
Wow. Well, that's interesting, because that's a big undertaking if you haven't, you know, been doing it your whole life. My my cousin, she started her medical career, I'm going to say in high school, you know, preparing to do it. So, you know, that's a lot to take from Brown.
I took no high school sciences.
Wow. Okay.
I didn't take any high school maths beyond geometry. So when I went back for my pre-medical coursework, I had to take calculus, and I had to take chemistry and physics and organic chemistry. And, you know, I look back on that now and I go, wow, I just did it. You know, when you're young, you just do these things.
Oh, sure. Well, you said another thing that sparked my attention, and I got this from my cousin. She worked in ended up working at the medical school. And one of the things you just said about people always wanted to talk to you, it speaks to maybe a natural inclination that some people have. Like, for example, my cousin said that a lot of the people in school that were graduating with the best grades, she knew would not make the best doctors. Some of the people who didn't have the grades that were quite that high were natural healers. They were just natural healers. So is that something that you feel as a psychiatrist, that some people just can relate to what the other person is saying and feeling a little better?
I think that's such an interesting, you know, separation of talents that you've just described. And I would say, yes, I fall into the smaller, much smaller group of physicians that, you know, are interested in healing, you know, the process of what it takes to heal somebody. And that does involve really good interpersonal skills.
Sure.
And, you know, if you think about, you know, the admissions process for medical school, the criteria do not pick for people who are interpersonally savvy. The criteria, you know, for admission are, you know, very high grades in the hard sciences and maths, that you're a really good standardized test taker, and that you have strong experience in research science work.
Yeah.
So I did all those things. I mean, my grades were good. My husband's grades were much better. He was a natural science person. And, you know, and he's also got the listening and interpersonal skills.
Sure.
But but when we were in training together, you know, he was interested in the mind and I was interested in the person.
Yeah.
And when I was being interviewed for residency, when you go to medical school in the last year, when you decide your field, you apply for residency training in a variety of programs, and you have to go and be interviewed. And I remember at Beth Israel in Manhattan, the attending who was interviewing me asked me why I wanted to be a psychiatrist. And what about it drew me? And as I, you know, thought about how I was going to answer it, and you know, the whole the interview experience for admission to a residency is also another game, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought to myself, well, you know, I should, you know, give him some patter about, you know, the science of mind and, you know, how we need to learn more about the brain. And I thought to myself, you know, it's not my area of strength. I really shouldn't go there. What if he starts asking me deeper questions about it? And I look like a jerk. So I said, I like psych patients. I like, you know, talking to people. I like getting the story. I like laughing. It's the one specialty where you can actually like be with the person and, you know, have a laugh. You know, if you're an internist, you know, you're asking about a specific organ system.
Yeah.
You know, you're not engaging in the same way. You know, to be a good psychiatrist, you have to be able to connect, you know, as a person, as a human being.
Yeah.
Otherwise, people just won't relax and tell you what's really troubling them.
Yeah.
And of course, that's true for any physician, but it's especially true. It's especially true in psychiatry.
Now, you describe yourself as a rural psychiatrist. What would be one of the differences between a rural psychiatrist and one that works in a big city, like New York or something like that?
Well, it's really a matter of it impacts your personal life. When we were working in New York, you know, New York is huge. The chances that you're going to run into a patient or a client are very small, you know.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But when you live in a small town, and my town is 23,000 people, and we raised our son here, you know, when he was in elementary school, I had to deal with patients who were in the, you know, PTA, the parent-teacher organization. I had to deal with people who, you know, there's a crossover between your personal life and your professional life. So I'm always, even when I'm out in the community, I don't have the privacy that I would have had if I had stayed in New York. And that means I have to carry myself differently. And it's, it was a struggle. You know, they don't train you in the residency for this kind of thing because most residencies are based in large urban centers. It's a challenge to have your own life while you're living in a fishbowl and you're basically a person who is known by everybody because of your status, your position, and, you know, not to feel constrained, not to feel like you have to hide yourself because it's impossible. You can't hide yourself.
Now, what are some of the most common conditions that a psychiatrist has to deal with? I'm guessing depression is probably pretty high up on the list.
Yes, depression, panic, anxiety. But what's one of the surprises of my 25 years of practice has been the prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh, okay.
The prevalence of physical and sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And in rural community, although I think this is probably true in urban communities too, just it's more masked, the incidence of substance abuse and alcoholism and how that fuels all the other psychiatric disorders.
Sure.
And lastly, in our small town, you know, it's not an economically thriving area. So poverty also an impacting variable.
Sure.
And it makes for a very different kind of practice. You know, I would say that compared to my colleagues that continue to live and work in New York, I take care of a much, much wider range of disorders and a much, much sicker patient population because we have no, we basically have no referral resources.
Oh,
interesting. You know, I'm like, it stops with me. The buck stops with me. It's even hard to admit somebody to the hospital.
Wow.
So I'm taking care of people who are much, much sicker than my colleagues in my office.
Yeah.
And that has made, that has its ups and it, that has its upside and its downside. You know, I have more confidence because I, you know, have to think my way through kind of more, you know, intensive life and death challenges. But it's less traditional in the sense that I do a lot less, you know, psychodynamic interpersonal therapy. It's much more pragmatic.
Yeah. Regarding stigma, here's my kind of take on stigma. I kind of believe that in regard to mental health, things are getting better. There's a lot of work that's been done about including with social media about mental health awareness and things like that. So things are getting better. But there was a stigma for a long time. If you had a mental health disorder, you know, you were like psycho. And I enjoyed those movies as much as anybody else.
Right.
But Norman Bates didn't do the best to represent, you know, mental health issues because, as I'm sure you well know, people that are suffering from mental health disorders are far more likely to be a victim than they are to be, you know, Anthony Perkins.
Perpetrator.
Yeah. So what are some of the stigma issues that you have run into and would like to talk about?
Well, I agree with you that things are better, but they're better in that kind of complicated way that things are better for women, but they're not really.
Oh, okay.
You know, the stigma against mental health issues is basically institutionalized. The support services, the monies for research, all of it, it's much, much less than, say, the more trendy infirmities like cancer or I don't know, you know, these things go in fads. For a while, there was a lot of money going into ALS, which was Lou Gehrig's disease. So like everything else, you know, there's a limited amount of resources, and those resources get allocated according to what's trendy at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, chronic mental illness, most psychiatric illness is chronic, and chronic illness is not popular in terms of even, you know, family practice, pediatrics, psychiatry. These are the least popular, the most demanding fields interpersonally. And, you know, you have to have the relationships, the ongoing relationships. But again, because doctors become doctors because they're good at, you know, solving math problems and doing science research, medicine itself is split into two groups. And, you know, the technicians, the surgeons, the people who work with gadgets, like, you know, the procedures.
Yeah.
And that's what insurance companies tend to reimburse the best for. You know, anything that's short term, that's not going to be an ongoing investment.
Right.
So, you know, brain disorders span the gamut. From dementia to schizophrenia to, you know, stroke to post-traumatic stress disorder from being, you know, severely sexually and physically abused as a child, which changes your brain neurology. You become a person, a permanently changed person because of that. Unstable, you know, not functioning at a capacity that is helpful, right? Mm-hmm. So the stigma is, you know, persists, but it persists differently. I think people, you know, in my rural practice, it's still very hard to get people to come in. You know, they're ashamed. They do feel like they're, you know, they're crazy if they have to come see the crazy doctor.
Yeah.
But the people that do come in are much more receptive. You know, they want the help. They want to learn how to think about the way they operate, so that they make better decisions. And that's the one thing that we have control over. We may not have control over, you know, the fact that we have panic and need to take medicine for that. We may not have control over the fact that we get depressed and need to take medicine for that. But we do have control over how we think about it and how we deal with people who don't treat us well,
yeah,
all of which, you know, predisposes you to flare-ups of whatever your chronic problem is.
Yeah. When you're going through some of these therapy sessions and you're interacting with some of your patients, do you ever, are they ever beneficial to you as the counselor?
Well, if by that you mean, you know, am I actively using the process to benefit myself? I would say, no, I don't,
right.
I don't do that because that's, you know, an exploitation of the patient who is hierarchically one down and vulnerable.
Yes.
And, you know, exposing themselves, that vulnerability to you so that you can help them. However, you know, when you engage with somebody in a meaningful way and you have a genuine human connection, all kinds of wonderful things happen that are beneficial to both of us. You know, of
sure.
course I learn from every, you know, I would say not a day goes by that I don't have some kind of a, you know, meaningful insight about their problem, humanity, you know, my place in it, you know, how I could do the work better, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yes, it's very meaningful work. I recommend it highly.
Was writing the book, to follow up real quick, was writing the book itself therapeutic to you in any way?
Well, sure. It, you know, whenever you engage in making any kind of art, and I would say that writing this book, you know, was making art. It's a creative process. And yes, there's always therapeutic benefit, not in the sense that I was healed of wounds, but rather that it grew me. It grew me as a person. It expanded my skill set. It gave me insights into the work and into how I do it. And it also helped me kind of, I did, when I was writing the chapters on my childhood and the training years, I did make another pass through some things that I hadn't fully understood.
Okay.
So it opened up, you know, it opened up my mind in a way that was really productive.
When did the idea come about? Now, the book, can, you know, in terms of its concept, is a collection of scenarios and some other things. When did the idea to formulate something like this come about?
Well, you know, I've always been, as you opened with, I'm an avid reader. I mean, I have always, always, always read to learn more about how the world works, about how people work, you know, how things run, right? How the world is, especially human, the human world. And when I became a resident and I started, you know, interviewing people, and especially in the third year when I was in the outpatient clinic and I worked with people over the course of a year or two, their stories were very interesting and thought provoking. And, you know, I started to have, that was the beginning, you know, just like taking an interest in the wide range of, you know, scenarios, how people live, how they adapt, you know, how they create lives for themselves, given the kinds of adversities that they're up against. And then, you know, as I, you know, became more experienced, I would say that the sense of needing to share what I've learned in its, and the fascination of it, it's not really, I mean, I suppose I had sort of a subliminal agenda that I wanted to, you know, educate people a little bit more about what psychiatric illness is about, what being a therapist is like, what's it like from my side of the couch? You know, what kind of a person does this work? What's involved? How do you have to manage yourself as a person to do this work? Because one of the other questions that people ask is, how do you go home at night? Doesn't it keep you up?
Yeah.
It's like, well, sometimes, but not in the way you would think. You know, that's one of the things that you learn is how to contain your own life without hardening yourself to others, you know? So I would say that now I've been in the boonies. I've been practicing in the boonies for 25 years, and I have nobody to teach. I'm not affiliated with an academic institution. And yet I feel I've learned so much. And it's also been so just interesting, you know? And people have such unreasonable expectations of what therapists and psychiatrists can do. And they also have very stereotyped and I would say quite frightening conceptions of what kind of people need psychiatric services and therapy. So I wanted to, you know, tell the story in a way that was entertaining and, you know, amusing, but also you know, thoughtful so that people could see how really complicated the work is.
Sure. Well, that kind of folds into what I was going to ask you next, which was what aspects of the material do you hope carry over to the reader?
Well, I hope they enjoy the book just as a good read, you know? And I hope that people who are therapists who are doing the work or people who are, you know, starting out their careers find it supportive. Because one of the fantasies that, you know, us therapists have, as well as people out in the community, is that we should know what we're doing at all times.
Yeah.
And that there should never, you know, you should avoid making mistakes at all costs. And, you know, my attitude as I've, you know, gained wisdom, so to speak, is, you know, you can't avoid making mistakes. It's just part of how we learn. In fact, we can't learn without making mistakes. If we did everything right all the time, you'd never learn anything. There's nothing interesting in it. It's kind of like reading, you know, a good book. What's interesting in a good story? You know, the trouble that, you know, the protagonist gets into, and then how do they get themselves out? And so that was, you know, when I kind of, that came to me as a flash, as an organizing principle for the book. I mean, people, you know, I'm always interested in seeing how people get themselves out of trouble.
Yeah.
And I figured it would be no different, you know, if somebody read about what I was doing. So, you know, part of being competent is thinking on your feet and, you know, working your way out of, you know, whatever it is that you've gotten yourself into. And sometimes it's not, you know, not that I've done anything, but that the patient ambushes me.
Sure.
And that's part of, you know, the challenge too, is how not to take that personally, how to make that work for the therapy. You know, it's the overriding operating principle is how can I use what's going on to benefit the patient? And that means embracing my own flaws.
Yeah.
You know, I can't be of benefit to the patient if I'm always protecting, you know, again, you know, like steeling myself to defend against my own limitations. You have to take your limitations and learn from them.
Yeah.
And that's also a great thing for patients to see. It's modeling for how to be.
Can you briefly describe the basic structure of the book to give the readers an idea of what to expect?
Sure. So the book is based on the aspect of my work where I maintain the connection, the human connection, the interpersonal connection with the patient. It's not about prescribing.
Okay.
So what's a shrink's life like? Well, it's just like yours, really, but it's informed with my database, my training. So I work a lot. And so the majority of the book is based on patient stories. And there are two running subplots of extended treatments with two specific patients that run about 20 years. And then there are stories of family life, you know, how is it to parent a kid who has two shrinks for parents.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Then there's, you know, married life. Then there's my dog, my co-therapist. She's definitely a character in the book. And then what else do I do as a psychiatrist? I read professional literature. So I have some spoof faux science research articles that are straightforward humor pieces featuring researcher I Am Trapped, MD, who publishes frequently in the esteemed science journal Family Health. And then there are pieces about the community and the crossover between my personal and professional life, you know, places where I have to work with a patient out in the community, mm-hmm. Or places where there's one piece called Mayday where I'm sick, I'm working sick, but I don't realize how sick I am and how that impacts my ability to work.
Sure.
And so it's that's the range. And then, of course, the other pieces, you're going to see me working with people with all different kinds of disorders, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, attention deficit disorder, depression, panic and anxiety, people with head injuries. And they're all people. They're all people.
Yeah.
It's, you know, one of the things that I want to get across was, you know, that there's a lot of adventure in working in this work. And the adventure comes from embracing the uncertainty and embracing the mistakes. And I make all different kinds of mistakes, things that, you know, I'm hoping that anyone who's in the field reads and says, oh, okay, I'm not going to make that one. Right. I'm going to go on ahead and make a different one. And so that's basically the structure of the book. Oh, and then there's the back of the shop story. There's a 5-part series about how we get ripped off by an insurance company and an employee and how we deal with that. So I'm giving you the range of, you know, the backstory on what it's like to do this work and live a life if you do this work. And I try to, you know, I do it with a light touch. There are chapters that are more intense than others. There are others that are more amusing than others. It's a mix, sure, like anything else.
Sure.
And, you know, given that we are caught in, you know, the COVID-19 quarantine for the indefinite future, probably, I don't know, a couple more months. It's April now. I anticipate that it'll go on at least through June. I think this book might be helpful to read just to see what you can do to kind of maintain being connected with others. Because in this, when you have to stay away physically, it's really important to maintain the emotional connection with people in whatever way you can.
Yeah.
And what I do really in this book is talk about all the different ways that I rise to the challenge or not. I sometimes fail of pulling, you know, repairing the breach, such as it is in the interpersonal connection.
Right.
So that's basically the gist.
Let me repeat the name of your book, which mm-hmm. is Practice, 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 This Psychiatrist's Life by Daniela V. Gitlin. Now, where can people find out more about you online?
Well, I blog. It's an informal blog. It's not sure. like, you know, psychiatric information per se. But, you know, everything I do is informed by my database. And the URL of my blog is danielagitlin.com.
Okay.
And the book is available on Amazon if you wanted to buy it.
Okay. And social media, do you have availability there?
Yeah, I have a Facebook site and Daniela V. Gitlin, MD. But I'm not unduly, you know, I'm not overly active on social media, okay. But I'm there. And I have a Twitter site. But again, I'm not unduly active there.
Okay. Well, that's fine. Let me repeat it one more time. The name of the book is Practice, 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 The Psychiatrist's Life by Daniela V. Gitlin, MD. Very interesting read. And as she said, it is available on Amazon. Absolutely interesting insights here, Daniela. Thank you very much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Again, the book is on Amazon, Practice, 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 The Psychiatrist's Life by Daniela V. Gitlin. Thank you very much for listening to our podcast today. And on behalf of HumorOutcast.com, all of the fine folks at HO Press, very talented writers over there. HumorOutcast.com has updated posts pretty much every day. And obviously, it's humor-oriented, but there's a lot of stuff there, societal commentary and political stuff and just a really good mix of content. Do check them out, HumorOutcast.com. I'm Billy Dees. Thank you very much for listening to our podcast today.